Hello, everybody. Welcome. Today we have a very special guest, Libby Walness. And Libby and I have had one other podcast together, and then we have had some classes together, and we both have this deep special interest around not only neurodiversity, but also neurodivergence and how that intersects with autism. So, neurodiversity refers to the concept that there are differences in the way that our brains and our nervous systems are functioning within the human population, that there's just natural variations, almost like, there's probably 2,000 different flowers, and flowers emerge in many different ways. And so the neurodiversity just means there's many ways that we all show up. But neurodivergent is a term used to describe individuals whose neurological development is considered divergent from the norm. And that could be self-identified, as in self-selected autism, ADHD, dyslexia, or it could be that there's actually a diagnosis that they've gone through the testing. So Libby is going to tell us all about this. She is just recently gone through the battery of tests to see where she lands on this spectrum. And I'm just so grateful that she's willing to share her personal story with us and then use that to help us understand how yoga therapy can be of benefit to people who are neurodivergent. All right, let's get into our show today. And again, just want to thank Libby for all of her openness. Thank you so much, Libby. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour, Season 7. Our goal with this podcast is to help you remember the goodness in life. Remember the goodness inside of you. Remember the goodness inside of everyone else. This world has been so challenging for many years now, and I think we need a reminder that it's going to be okay. We're going to be okay. We can trust ourselves to make it through this challenging life. And this podcast is your reminder. Each and every week, we have a special guest who's going to come here and remind you it's going to be okay. We got this together. Hello, Libby. So nice to be with you today.
Hi, Amy. Thank you for having me again.
And thank you for joining us. Tell us where you're at in the world.
Well, right now I'm still in Houston, Texas, Conqua land, and behind me is a beautiful place in Detroit, but I'm just, at home enjoying morning in the same time zone as you. How are you?
I know. So, for those listeners who haven't heard yet, I've said it so many times, but I recently moved from California to Minnesota, and I'm just so happy here. I love it here. And Libby, are you going to be moving somewhere before the end of the year?
Yeah, before the end of the year, hopefully before hurricane season gets too much, I'll be moving back to my childhood home of Billings, Montana. And I'm really looking forward to that. Yeah.
Can we just take a moment? First of all, my father's from there. Something I want to say, because you said the land that you're on, there is something in one's bones when you move back to your childhood home, as I did, and you are about to. There's just a sense of safety for me. And I know that might not be true for everyone, because not everyone has safe families and safe communities. But I think it's so interesting how the land impacts us, the smell, the clouds that you're familiar with, the type of rain that comes. I mean, it's fascinating to me.
Yeah, I agree. It really is. And two things that you said really strike me in the context of our conversation coming up are those sensory experiences, like especially the scent, right? And the feeling of the air on your skin, right? Really different between somewhere humid or somewhere dry, somewhere cold, somewhere warm. Yeah. And then also the familiarity. When something is familiar or predictable, or you have some kind of expectation that you know is most likely to be met, that is so profoundly comforting to me. And I think to a lot of people, particularly a lot of people who may have a lot of stress in their lives, right, that they may come to yoga for,
So I can't wait to get into both of these. And I don't know why it never occurred to me, even though I'm having this very sensory experience here in my new home. And you're right, it's familiarity. the way people talk, the way they are polite, the Minnesota nice rage. There's a familiarity that I just get. And I always felt like a fish out of water in California because I was like, who are these people? Why are they acting like this? So let's get into our topic of the day. Why don't you go ahead and introduce what we're here to discuss?
Oh, well, as far as I know, we are here to discuss, in the context of yoga therapy, neurodiversity, especially autism. And I think this is kind of my official public coming out that I have a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder.
Can we stop there for a moment?
Oh, okay.
I feel a little emotional. I didn't realize.
Oh, it's so sweet. I mean, I've known for a long, long time and I've been told, you know, but I didn't have it on paper because my psychiatrist said, well, first of all, you don't really need it. And, you know, because why? And second, it may cause legal issues for certain things. And so but now I have the paper. They did all the super special tests, not just the interview. Yeah, I've been told I don't have ADHD, that was an incorrect diagnosis, that all of it just comes, all of my, you know, executive dysfunction things come from the autism. And I thought, huh, so I lost one identity, but I've been kind of confirmed and validated in this other identity. And it has been more than anything validating, right? To know, oh, that's why. Oh, that's what happened. And
so we have to unpack this. I know for you, you're like, okay, let's get into the material. But for me, this is the material, the personal experience, as well as what can our listeners learn from your experience, if you're willing to share. So I heard you say you always kind of knew and people told you. What is it like?
So I didn't always know because it wasn't really on my radar, you know, it's not on most people's radar unless they've come into contact with someone autistic or, you know, watched a movie or something that struck them. But when I was filling out all the questionnaires and things for my son's multiple evaluations and diagnoses, I was filling out these parent questionnaires and I went, as many, many autistic parents do when they have autistic children, I thought, gosh, if my mom had filled this out when I was a kid, she would have said the exact same thing, you know, except for the language delay my son had. But I thought otherwise, oh my gosh, this is me. And I knew that. And
that's how a lot of parents find out.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. When they're late diagnosed, because if you aren't really obvious, especially if people who are born female, right, assigned female at birth, really, we do a lot better job, frankly, of masking and camouflaging and kind of fitting in. A brain-based thing or a society thing or both, probably both, like, we don't know. But so we tend to go under the radar. You know, we don't get picked up. Yeah.
All right. And so after you saw all these questions and you thought my mother would probably have answered yes to a lot of these, then you decided to wait for your own personal reasons. And how did it feel when they came back and said, yeah, you officially have this diagnosis?
Well, I started with kind of floating the idea that I had ADHD with the psychiatrist I was with at the time, and that was in my late 30s. And she said, oh yeah, I totally believe that. Here's some Ritalin, you know, go for it. This was after she determined I didn't actually have bipolar. So I initially had a misdiagnosis of bipolar II, which is extremely common, especially for women, you know, who are later diagnosed autistic. I had a DBT therapist who I'm pretty sure thought I had borderline personality disorder. But as a DBT guy, he probably just saw that everywhere. So I don't know. He didn't tell me, but I'm pretty sure based on the things he was asking. But after the psychiatrist kind of ruled those things out, she said, okay, we'll try, you know, with the ADHD. I believe you, you know, and so now that was in my chart or whatever. And she ran later. I kind of got the courage to ask for autism, not really full assessment, but like doing the interview, the questionnaires. And she didn't want to do that, but my next psychiatrist did. And so in the clinic, he said, yeah, you can comfortably say that, you know, that you're autistic, but we talked about having it actually on paper in the chart and so forth. And we didn't do that at the time. And it wasn't a full neurodevelopmental assessment. So I didn't have all the little IQ tests and perceptual things and so on. But I went and did that very recently, just this year. And I got the full battery of tests, the full neurodevelopmental assessment with a clinical psychologist. And she's like, yeah, no ADHD, but we're doubling down, you know, on the autism. And it's interesting is that as part of that assessment, she sent questionnaires to my mother, who endorsed absolutely zero, except for the strange movements question, you know, because I did a lot of weird movements as a kid, but everything else was none. My psychiatrist said, this is actually really fairly common, you know, for parents who either are kind of in denial or because the whole family has been neurodivergent the whole time And so like the threshold is really high for abnormality, right? Yes. And I had a brother with significant needs who, looking back, was clearly autistic, but he had a lot more obvious issues and differences and, you know, also had brain injury. So like my mom's threshold, of course, must have been very high.
So I love
you're normal.
So I know there's within the neurodivergent community, there are some people that say, yes, I want a diagnosis. I want to have some explanation for why my damn life has been so hard and all the things that happened to me and not understanding how life works. And then there's other people that are saying, I really don't want that label. I don't want to be put in that camp. I'm a unique individual, but I don't actually want to be diagnosed. Did you feel like, yes, I would like to know?
I felt like I wanted to know for a few reasons. First of all, just for the urge to know, just to be certain, particularly to be certain that, or kind of to be externally validated, you know, in that my perceptions of myself were accurate. You know, first of all, that's probably, you know, a symptom in itself, but like, you know, really, but everybody wants that, right? Everybody wants to think that they know
themselves. Some precision around this diagnosis.
So that in itself is just satisfying, you know?
Yeah.
But also if I would be interacting with people, say there's a lot of online autistic groups that I belong to, autistic adult groups, and most of them these days are accepting of self-diagnosis because it is so inaccessible to many people to get an official diagnosis. But at the same time, there's huge imposter syndrome around saying, oh, me too, but maybe I'm not, because I don't really have, you know, that many problems, or it's not really enough. And that ties in, you know, a lot of people will be familiar with that, whether they're autistic or not, you know, with shame or with a trauma history or something, this feeling that like, I'm not worthy to put my difficulties out there or whatever. And just having the diagnosis, I think, reduces that imposter syndrome quite a bit. And I do like labels, because labeling and classifying and categorizing, that's fun, right?
That's a special interest.
I wouldn't like to do that. That's weird. But I can see why people, if they see it as something limiting, if they see it as I have a label and now people will only see me as that thing if I say that. Of course, that's a totally valid concern. And it, you know, was a concern of mine, you know, for certain legal reasons. There are still some places in the world where you'd have trouble, obstacles, if not like just be outright rejected to get a visa to move there if you are autistic, because you're seen as a burden on a healthcare system, for example. So there are world consequences, you know, or if a job interviewer finds out, they can suddenly see you in a totally different light. Physicians will see you in a totally different light. And there's a lot of diagnostic overshadowing happening, especially again, for people born female. So there are lots of reasons why you might not want a diagnosis. But I think the more that we start to see autism as a kind of natural difference in neurology, there's going to be less stigma around it. That's not to say that it isn't disabling. And that's not to say that it's not a problem for many, many people. You know, the symptoms, the differences that we have can be really problematic in lots of areas of life. But that doesn't mean that we should be in denial about what those problems come from. I think it doesn't help you if you want to solve your problems, if you don't know why they're there, or you won't acknowledge why they're there.
Yeah. And I think that's also interesting. There's such a wide variety of symptoms. I mean, anybody can Google it and see so many symptoms. And then even within those symptoms, the neurodiversity of the neurobiology, like intensity of symptoms, it's a lot. So can you talk about some of the main ones that you had experienced that kind of made you feel like, maybe I should go see if I have autism?
Yeah. Well, like I said, a lot of them came up on my son's, you know, diagnostic questionnaires. So they mostly were about the diagnostic criteria, right, out of the DSM. And for me, if I want to think of examples, I can think of examples out of my life to fit into any of those criteria. But for me, a really, really strong component is the sensory sensitivities, which you'll see a lot.
That's like if someone comes into a room wearing perfume, it could just overwhelm you, or going to a rock concert, the sound just may not be tolerable, or a lot of bright lights. I mean, just I want to unpack it, because when you hear sensory experiences, like, what does that even mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, our senses include not just the kind of the five main ones, the smell and the taste and the touch and the sight and the hearing, but also proprioception, knowing where the body is in space, our sense of balance, our vestibular sense, our interoception, our ability to be aware of what's happening inside our body and interpret those signals. All these things are part of sensory experience. And I would argue also that neuroception, that idea, like if you read Stephen Porges' work on polyvagal theory, he talks about neuroception as kind of part of this. Use our nervous system to interact with other people, and our sense of safety with somebody, our sense of threat with them is kind of its own sense in a way. And so I would kind of put it in that category for autistic people, because a lot of our issues come in interaction, you know, with other people. Sometimes we don't read cues correctly, or we don't see little subtle nonverbal body language things.
I hear a lot of people with autism say they're reading it correctly. They're seeing very subtle things. And it's actually probably accurate, meaning like the fake smile with the phony words don't actually go with the neuroception that they're feeling from this person. And everyone else in the room is willing to go along with the lie, but they can't. They're just like, what? That person is not happy right now. So do you really think it's that they're not picking up on cues, or we're not picking up on
cues? I think
cues?
We're not picking up on it in the way that is intended to be picked up on, because there's like two layers going on here, right? There's the thing that someone's doing. Someone's like this, you know, and you're supposed to like subconsciously, intuitively pick up that this means I have a problem with what you're saying. Maybe I want you to stop talking, right? Like, this is a thing. And I know that because I've been, you know, taught that that's what that means. And I think that when autistic people, you know, they don't intuitively know that kind of second layer, right? But what, you know, that it's intended to kind of send a message. What they're seeing is this, and they know that this means something, you know, that something is
be quiet right now,
right? But we might not know like what the intended message is. We just know that something's off, something's incongruent. But
right.
I don't know what that incongruity is. I don't know if that makes sense, but
it totally makes sense. Yeah. I'm really having a lot of empathy for this and resonating with what you're saying. And you know, a lot of people are saying that autistic people actually take in almost like, I heard 40% more information than everyone else. So there's also like this brain and nervous system processing of massive amounts of information over and above what a normie might have. And I could imagine that could be overwhelming and take time to digest and figure out. Do you believe that's true or not?
I do. And there's also research, very, very recent research, more into like sensory motor brain differences about, again, there's always conflicting research, right? This is the problem with autism research. There's always conflicting evidence, but about difficulties with low level perceptual functioning, that you're not picking up this, like these low level signals about what like movement changes mean, for example. This is, I think, part of why there used to be this theory that autism was a deficit in the mirror neuron system. And that was thought to be like emotional empathy and things like, but that's not what that part of the cortex does, right? It's more about this low level perceptual interaction with movement that we're seeing.
Are you talking about, like, my husband and I laugh all the time, and I've never been diagnosed with autism, but I definitely think I have some neurodivergence.
Highly sensitive person.
What I was going to say is I, in my whole life, have never really been able to ride a bike safely. And my husband's like, why not? Like, we'll get you big fat mountain bike tires. I'm like, honey, it doesn't matter how big the tires are. My body can't sense those little shifts from right to left. And I'm halfway over on the sidewalk before I even realize the bike is not going in the right direction. I cannot ride a bike unless it has three wheels. Get me a tricycle. Is that what you're talking about when you say?
Well, yes and no. I mean, what I was talking about was us perceiving other people's movements and interpreting them, or even picking up on them, you know, in the way that most people would. But also, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of motor issues with autism. It could be gross motor. You know, a lot of us have a weird gait, you know, kind of weird ways of moving, a weird posture. And weird, okay, I'm saying weird, but insert whatever word you prefer, right? It's atypical, it's altered, it's different. And riding the bike, my balance is horrible too. Like, it took me a very long time to learn to ride a bike on two wheels. Also fine motor too. Sometimes it can be really great, but for me, it's really bad. It took me a very long time to be able to tie my shoes, for example, much, much, much later than my peers. Yeah, no, I know.
It's so funny. I'm just going to say this. All of my really good friends and the people I feel immediately comfortable with are probably neurodivergent.
Yeah.
Is that a common thing too, that
we
when
move
you
in past.
Are that, you just feel comfortable with your people?
Yeah, I mean, there's a thing that we move in packs. There's just some memes out there about that, that like it should be a questionnaire, or that you should throw somebody in with a bunch of confirmed diagnosed individuals and see how quickly they respond to each other, and then you'll know.
Yeah.
But I think this is maybe partly because of the double empathy problem. This was developed, Milton Damien, he's in the UK, sociologist, is autistic, came up with this theory, I want to say in 2012. So it's been around for a while. And the studies that his group did, I think they were comparing neurotypical to autistic. So I don't know to what extent this might apply to non-autistic people who have another kind of neurodivergence. I could be wrong about that. At any rate, it's usually extrapolated to mean that neurodivergent people generally communicate better with each other. Autistic people definitely communicate better with each other. They communicate just fine with each other. And neurotypical people communicate, you know, generally speaking, just fine with each other. And the problem comes when they're communicating with one another, right? And so the reason that's significant is because it kind of upends the idea that all of the communication problems reside within the autistic individual, right? Mm-hmm. You don't understand what I'm saying, therefore your understanding is flawed. And I don't understand what you're saying, therefore your communication is flawed. Wait a minute, that's, you know, it's all one-sided, right? Why can't neurotypical people learn to communicate with autistics just the way we have to learn to communicate with them? That's the idea. And I think part of the reason we get along with each other so well is because we just understand what we mean, right? We're communicating well.
And I think the directness, it almost feels like you don't have to sugarcoat everything and try to be socially appropriate. Like, there's an understanding that we're just going to say what we think and we love each other. And honesty is actually a love language.
Yeah.
That we can just be ourselves, and that 100% acceptance of showing up as yourself is my way to love you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. Or also that expression of empathy, of bringing up a personal story that's relatable. A lot of times that's interpreted as being, oh, you're turning it around, making it all about yourself. That's so selfish. You have no empathy. But really, it's the way of saying, no, I really understand you. I really know what you mean. I really do have empathy. I'm not just saying it, you know? And so that's a really different, that comes up a lot, really different way of communicating empathy. But I want to actually just mention really quick, because you talked about directness and honesty, and you also talked about how you're finding comfort in the Minnesota nice, which is kind of the opposite, right? You know, the rules, right?
I don't find comfort in it. I get it.
You get it. And that's the comfort.
I get it. I truly understand from living in Midwest for my whole life that there's going to be people who are smiling and being very friendly and very pleasant and very sweet. But when I feel that rage that is actually there, like, I can trust that. I know, oh, they're really unhappy. It may be about me. It may just be, you know, there's rage inside. It doesn't really matter. But I wouldn't say I like it, but I know it. There's familiarity with, oh, the smiley rage lady.
Yeah, exactly. So there are rules, right? And you learn them. And so you can interact in the way that's expected because you learned the rules. But you had to learn those rules, right? Like you.
Right. And I never figured out the rules in California.
Right.
I don't know if there are rules there, but if in the 25 years that I lived there, I never figured it out.
Well, because even as an adult.
Yeah.
Hello. Are you interested in polyvagal theory? Well, if so, I have two really cool things you might be interested in. One is an app called the Mighty Network, where Marlisa Sullivan and myself are hosting a yoga therapy and polyvagal theory group, and it's free. You can just join the group, come in and share thoughts and ideas on polyvagal theory, yoga, and yoga therapy. We try to post every week, stimulating a community around yoga, the nervous system, and polyvagal theory. So we'd love to have you join us. In addition, we are giving a 7-week class on polyvagal theory and yoga starting in the fall. You can find that on www.polyvagalinstitute.org. O-R-G. So we'd love to invite you to that 7-week course that's starting in September of 2024.
So let's get into, where does autism and yoga therapy intersect? What is it that you believe yoga therapy can help people with autism understand about themselves, the world, how to interact, how to feel safe? You know, I'm going to open up the floor for you.
Oh, gosh. Well, first of all, I want to be clear that I don't promote yoga therapy as like a therapy for autism. You know, you're not treating condition. First of all, we're not qualified to treat, you know, it's not really our scope of practice to try to treat something like that, whether or not you believe it should be treated, or to what extent you could work with somebody who had really, really deep disabilities, such as, you know, not really being able to care for their personal hygiene because they physically can't do it, something like that. That's not really in a yoga therapist's scope. But I think what we would be working with would be kind of the secondary sort of fallout symptoms, you know, such as anxiety or depression, which are super, super common, which makes sense, especially if you're late diagnosed and you grew up just knowing you're wrong in the world, but you can't really do anything. Of course, you're going to be anxious and depressed. And in fact, there's research into a particular kind of anxiety, this autism-specific anxiety, that it, if you're autistic, you pretty much basically everybody has this, that you have anxiety related to interactions you have with people in the world, you know, based on your autism. And that's not the same thing as just a random person with social anxiety or with generalized anxiety disorder. It's a little different.
But when you're saying this, especially if just feeling wrong in the world, the thing that came to me was yoga and yoga therapy are all about building sovereignty and learning to listen to that deep voice inside of yourself and follow an internal cue instead of all the cues of the external world. And I can just imagine the freedom that that permission would give. Like, you don't have to go figure out every external thing out there. You don't have to fit a square peg into a round hole. You don't have to be something you're not anymore. Like, it's okay to go in and be you and be different and let yourself be the leader mind of yourself.
No, absolutely. And I think that's right. And I think that one of the biggest things that yoga therapy offers in that way is the ability to kind of have multiple entry points into an individual learning better self-awareness. Because especially if you are autistic, you are very much more likely to have either too little or too much interoception. And it may be too little in one kind of area and too much in another, you know, like you could maybe have very little awareness of when you're hungry, but you may have really, really too much awareness of when you're, say, nervous or in pain of some kind. It may be really overwhelming in a way that it wouldn't be for someone else. So it's not always the same, you know, for everybody, but being able to become aware of what these internal signals are doing, how they connect to thoughts, how we can know if we need to bring a signal down for comfort or if we need to amplify it a bit in ourselves, you know, to take care of a need that it's expressing. Yoga therapy can help with these things, not just with mindfulness, like tracking sensations and stuff, although that helps, but also with embodiment. Because a lot of times autistic people have alexithymia. They're not able to kind of identify cognitively and put words to what they're feeling. And yoga therapy is a really great thing to help with that for anybody, you know. Also, that kind of ties into co-occurring conditions. You'll see that kind of alexithymia or that mistrust of the body or that unawareness of the body in things like PTSD or eating disorders. And both of those things happen a lot in autistic populations. Again, partly because of how we move in the world and have been, you know, kind of shot down by society a lot, but also because of these kind of uneven, intense sensory experiences. And so I think a lot of yoga therapists have skills for those kind of groups, and they could translate those easily to working with a lot of autistic people. And then yoga therapists can work with other co-occurring conditions too that happen a lot with autism, like hypermobility or digestive system issues or allergies. For some reason, like allergic reactions, like mast cell activation syndrome comes up a lot in autistic populations, and ADHD, other neurodivergent populations too. So a yoga therapist can help with that a lot. But I think really that self-awareness is so important because that's kind of the starting point for self-regulation, which really is huge. If you're in a sensorily overwhelming environment, how do you regulate? Yoga therapy is right there with all of our breathing practices and mindfulness and so forth. And like you said, just being in the relationship, being safe to learn it with somebody who's not judging you alone will be helpful too.
Hey, I'm writing that one down. Safe relationship. So I was in Pilates this morning and I had a moment that a lot of people exercise to burn calories and to get their body to look a certain way or to reduce their cholesterol. But for me, when I'm exercising, am trying to befriend my body, connect with my body, feel my body, because half the time I can't even feel it. And I'm always going slower than everybody else. I'm always like tuned in, like, okay, which arm is moving and which leg, you know.
Yeah.
And it just occurred to me, people with chronic pain, people with neurodivergence, and maybe even people who are over or underweight by their own self standards, there tends to be this lack of interoceptive awareness, and that exercise can be that, like instead of calorie counting and burning and getting fit. So I don't know, that was kind of an aha moment for me this morning. Like, oh, that's how I use exercise. It's not about getting in shape, if you will.
Right. Yeah, of course. Especially when we think about, you know, including asana or movement practices in yoga therapy, you're learning to tune into what those feelings are and you're getting feedback. You know, if you're just in a class, you might get lost, but with a yoga therapist one-on-one, you're getting direct feedback. The person can say, oh, okay, did you notice? So I was in a workshop one time and the instructor was having us do kind of a lunge and having us move the back, kind of a calf muscle stretch, moving the back heel up and down, but not move the knee. That was the instruction. The assistant came over to me and she said, are you aware that you're moving your knee? And I really wasn't. I had no idea. And then she put her hands around my knee and suddenly I could feel it moving because she gave that proprioceptive feedback, you know, and that's something that a yoga therapist potentially could do, you know, with consent and, you know, if it's appropriate, but that you might not get in a general class. And also if you're doing particular asana, particular exercises that your yoga therapist thinks will help you, you can get some really strong input, especially in strong postures, such as like warrior poses or something. You can get really strong input that will feed up into areas of the brain like the ACC, the anterior cingulate cortex, and the insula. And that can actually help. And this has been studied in populations that were not necessarily autistic, but that can actually help clarify and kind of help you reinterpret your sense of self, your sense of awareness, your sense of your body. This is looked at in like eating disorder populations, for example, and you can start to more accurately interpret your sensations, right? And like you said, that's what it's for. Yeah. Not that fitness is bad, but that's what it's, you know, yoga is for.
I don't know why that is such a unique. You know, I was in Pilates, but I agree with you. Yoga therapy, that's what we're doing.
I mean,
too.
Yeah.
And, you know, yoga is never going to burn enough calories to make it like a big workout anyway. So I think it's always been, even if we look back at the ancient times, yoga therapy has been about self-connection, going inward, turning your senses inward, quieting your mind, feeling what's going on inside of you. And it just, it's really cool that that is exactly what a lot of neurodivergent people actually could benefit from.
Could definitely benefit from it. And also, you know, being able to become aware of what your reactions are to the outside world, regulating through them so you can more accurately perceive the outside world. And I think that's borne out in the older texts too. I mean, like Patanjali, for example, you know, would favor correct perception of even just, you know, the outside world. You don't just jump straight into turning inward, like you can't, because the outside world will pull at you. And if you're not correctly perceiving the outside world, you're never going to be able to like detach from it, because your brain is going to constantly be trying to hook into it to figure it out, because that's what your brain does, right? I think we should bring the autistic way into this, sort it, categorize it, classify it, you know, do some Tarka and just figure it out. Figure out what's happening in the world around you. You can't do that unless you can hold your mind in one point. You can't do that if you're panicking. And yoga therapy can help you so you don't panic. And then that's the starting point.
You know, I also heard a therapist say recently with respect to this kind of embodiment discussion that many people with neurodivergence have a hard time turning inward and really feeling what's going on inside of them. But if we can bring ourselves to a neutral place. So it's not like you've actually connected in yet, but you're kind of like, you're not out there. Mm-hmm. You may not be completely connected in here, but you're just neutral and learn that first. And then eventually things can turn inward and start having that interoceptive awareness. And so I thought that was an interesting thought too, that what does that neutral place look like for a while, where we've kind of halfway pulled the senses in. They're not connected out there, but they're actually not inside either. So just a thought.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting thought. I think it's probably a smarter way of saying what I was just trying to say, that you have to get to a point where you're not being pulled outward, which is really tough when you are really sensitive to sensory input. As you know, it's really tough to meditate if that electricity buzz, you know, is happening in the room, or if, you know, there's a smell that's wafting around. Just being able to deal with that is the first step. But then this kind of halfway point, I think, is interesting, because I think that might happen not only sensorily, but also, well, yes, sensorily, because this is an internal sense thing. I'm thinking about people trying to meditate. And one thing that comes up a lot for autistic people with meditation is the expectation of being still, physically still, which sometimes is not possible, is not comforting. And again, you might see this in, say, PTSD or something too. It's not exclusive to autism, but we do listen. So underneath my camera right now, I'm doing this the whole time I'm talking to you. You know, I'm stimming a little bit because I'm a little nervous, but a lot of times that kind of stim can become a body-wide thing. You know, you see the rocking or you see the, you know, the movement. And a lot of times that is discouraged because the yoga teacher will look at someone and go, well, you know, can you make yourself more still? But that actually becomes more anxiety producing for some people, especially autistic people, you know, and then this kind of halfway point between what and what, you know, are we totally outward or totally inward? Are we totally still or are we moving? Is there kind of this little movement? Maybe that makes your mind still, but your body's still moving. So maybe this kind of in-between space is appropriate.
Yeah, I went to a Zen meditation retreat one time. I think it was 5 days. And if you moved at all, you got the stick. That was not a fun retreat for me. But it brings to mind something that, and you don't know any of these questions because I didn't even know them coming into this. So if there's anywhere you're like, I don't know, Amy, just that's too deep. Just tell me to shut up. But I feel like there's like this hierarchy in yoga and meditation, kind of an ableist hierarchy where like, if you are the perfect meditator, you will be able to sit with your legs crossed in lotus perfectly still for X amount of hours. Like, I just so viscerally reject that hierarchy. And even people like gymnasts or nothing against them, but there are certain people that through their childhood training, they became hyper flexible. And then when they get into a yoga class, they're doing all these hyper flexible poses and everyone is like, oh my gosh, that yoga person is so amazing in their practice. I don't know. I just reject that hierarchy of how it looks from the outside versus what you're saying, maybe a gentle rocking is actually bringing the mind to a still point. And why isn't that okay?
Yeah. Well, I think it is okay more and more with I think there is kind of an opening up in a lot of yoga spaces, you know, to kind of a tolerance, if not an acceptance, right, of differences like body size or disabilities or whatever. So I think it's getting better, but you still have, you know, the Instagram culture around yoga and this whole idea that if your asana game is strong, then you must be really good. Well, I used to live and breathe asana for a long time. Okay. And I used to compete on stage in asana championships. Mm-hmm. And I don't have a problem with that. I think that it can be used for very positive purposes. It can also be weaponized against self and against others. So this idea that it needs to look right on the outside is, I think, something for to talk about autistic people particularly, I think that's something that we are burdened with enough in our life, our daily life, you know, constantly monitoring, constantly being vigilant, if not hypervigilant, you know, am I holding my body in the way that this other person is going to perceive as correct or as non-threatening or as whatever? Why do you want to bring that into your yoga practice, right? Why would you want that? Because you need to move the opposite direction or you will never do anything but live your life based on how other people are perceiving you. You know, always be anxious, always be stressed. You'll never know what your real needs are. I mean, you can't meet your needs if you don't know what they are. So back again to embodiment, back again to internal awareness.
I just love what you're saying. I just want to keep repeating it, like different words for the same thing. Like people are living their lives. And I think there's non-autistic people that are doing this too, by the way.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Sure.
Living their lives to meet some external expectation that they perceive, which may or may not be accurate, so that they can feel comfortable and make other people feel comfortable. And it's so ironic because number one, you could never feel comfortable doing that. Like you may feel temporarily comfortable to make everyone feel like you're fitting in, but you're abandoning ourselves. You, me, us, we're abandoning ourselves to try to fit into an external narrative that we are imagining they want to see. And my experience now is that my projection of what I think they want to see isn't even correct. I can't even guess it if I try. And here I am giving up my sovereignty to try to be this thing that doesn't exist. It's actually insanity.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it is. And I think that, like you said, a lot of other people who aren't autistic live that way. Some of them might be misdiagnosed or undiagnosed autistic, maybe, but I'm sure some total normies live that way too, based on their upbringing or what happened to them. I think that it might happen to a very deep extent, you know, among autistic people. And there are plenty of autistic people who are not able to mask in that way, you know, who are not able to, or absolutely refuse to, which in its own way is lovely, to refuse to or unable to present an outward appearance of, you know, being correct. I need to be really careful. I feel like that there are people who are autistic who are not going to present like I do, right? Who are not going to be speaking full right. stop, right? Let alone speaking in an interview, or who are not going to be typing to engage online, and who are not going to be moving with precise movements in a beautiful yoga flow type of thing. But they can still benefit from being in a relationship with someone whose job it is to, like a yoga therapist, right? To have unconditional positive regard, just like a good psychotherapist will have, to have empathy, you know, for the client in front of them, and to be congruent, you know, to have their words and actions and their expressions and everything match. And that I think is so comforting. And even if you don't work on anything else because the person's overwhelmed like all the time, or they don't have the motor skills or whatever, you could have that therapeutic relationship. And that relationship comes in lots of different forms. Like I think a yoga therapist would need additional training to work with someone with intellectual disability, someone who doesn't speak, I mean, unless they have the same sign language or something, that sort of thing, or someone with severe physical disabilities, like you'd need more training. But then they can find that therapeutic relationship with a speech and language pathologist or an occupational therapist, someone like that. So I think yoga therapy is just one way to get at this relationship.
Yeah, I love all of that. Just that. I mean, I think you could get a lot of that from a good psychologist also. But I think the yoga therapist has this added benefit of helping someone also feel embodied.
Embodied, yeah.
While doing those things.
Right. And the yoga therapist will be embodied. The yoga therapist will be grounded, you know, assuming they use their skills that they know, whereas a psychotherapist may or may not be.
Yeah.
You know? And they may come at it from more a problem solving kind of top down perspective, whereas the yoga therapist is less likely to come at it that way.
Yeah. I'm remembering back to the first autistic student that I ever worked with, who was very intense symptoms. And I just felt so ill equipped. Like I didn't know what the heck I was doing. I didn't know if I was helping, if I was hurting. So I hope anyone listening today can really take away this message that you've talked about, that a safe relationship where there's unconditional positive regard, appropriate, really true empathy, and that congruence of, you know, my heart is matching my face and my speech and how I'm thinking, like they're all going together, you know, like that's probably just showing up like that is probably 60, 70% of the goodness that's going to come out of a session together.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I wish someone had told me that early on. Here I was like thinking, I have to do something for the autism.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and the thing is, you can't really know what you need to do for the autism because it's going to be so wildly different between individuals.
Yeah. So focus on that therapeutic safe relationship and then look at what's happening. Is there alexithymia? Is there hypermobility? Is there digestive issues? Are there anxiety or depression? Is there, you know, like just look at those symptoms and just work with them individually as you would any person who doesn't have autism.
Sure. And I think even more than you would for any random person, or maybe assume everyone's autistic just in case, right? Maybe do it that way. Just like you assume everyone might have trauma, right? And a lot of that will overlap. But more than anything else, just don't assume that you understand the meaning behind anything. If there's a body language, don't assume you know the subtext. Don't assume there is subtext. Take the words that they're saying. This was one of the biggest things. There's been some research in the last couple of years, especially coming out of Canada, on MBSR, for example, mindfulness-based stress reduction. And one of the biggest things in those kinds of studies, mindfulness for autistic people, also in healthcare issues for autistic people, one of the biggest issues that their words were not being listened to as their words, that the person with them was constantly trying to figure out what they were really saying. And they weren't there was no subtext. They were just saying the words.
So like, they were really saying what they were
I really mean what I'm saying. Like, so the only assumption I would say to make is that, like, assume that they mean what they say. And if you don't know something, ask. Like, don't just assume that the digestive upset is from anxiety, or don't just assume that, you know, the hypermobility is there and therefore they have, you know, lots of flexibility in all their joints or something, you know, just like really don't assume stuff, because that's where you're going to come in against power, or that they're autistic and therefore they have alexithymia. They may not, you know, you can't assume anything. And I think that's the biggest point.
Which is so interesting, because ultimately, shouldn't we be doing that for all people?
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
Instead of projecting our stories and meaning and all the things from our experience and our values onto this person and assuming we know.
Right. Of course. I mean, I think that you run up against this in academic circles too. Like, if we just pretended like everybody had trauma, if we just pretended like everybody was autistic, I think it would help most people, you know? So yeah, why not?
Is there any last words of wisdom? I feel like you've given us so much goodness and a lot of information packed into a very short period of time. So some people might need to go back and listen and stop the tape and Google. And I feel like there's been so much given in this time together. But is there any last little thing that you want us to know about yoga therapy and autism?
I think only what I said is that you need to approach an autistic client, and really any client, with the knowledge that they have an internal wisdom of what they need. And your job is not to figure it out, but to help them raise their own awareness so they can uncover it themselves.
And create a safe environment to do that, because the world has not been a safe place to be able to explore in that way.
So not, yeah, that therapeutic relationship is absolutely key. But again, you know, for anybody, but especially for autistic people who probably don't have that in a lot of places in their life, if at all.
And I'm going to say something that I hope doesn't hurt your or anyone else's feelings, but in the years that I've have worked with autistic people, usually their parents, at least in my practice, have been heavily involved. I have felt like the parents were not allowing for that sovereignty and the inner voice of the child or adult child, if you will, to be heard and seen and respected. You know, I think it's hard.
Yeah, it's very hard for parents. And as a parent of an autistic child, you know, who also is out, he's like, I'm proud of it. You can tell anybody you want. So just, I want to be very clear that I'm not going to be anti-parent. A lot of autistic advocacy spaces have turned into kind of parent bashing spaces. And I'm not here for that, because as a parent of an autistic child, I know it's profoundly terrifying. Like, if he runs into traffic, because he knows to look both ways and he looks both ways, but then he goes, regardless of what's happening, you know, and my brother did that too. So yeah, there's a reason, you know, there's a reason behind that. You know, there's this sense of like kind of being controlling and stuff that comes from raising them from a small child, and you're in fear for their life quite literally many times. And being able to let go of that is difficult for any parent, right? In any situation. And also
and maybe a lot not of even it, appropriate, right?
Right,
and
right. Yeah.
Safety.
For safety. And that's really the main, I think, usually the main thing. Also keep in mind, a lot of parents may be undiagnosed autistic as well. And so that there may be a lot of kind of control issues because of that. Things need to be the right way for their internal well-being. They need to be kept a certain way. It happens a lot. But I think if we're working with autistic adults, you know, as yoga therapists, there might be a little less of that involvement. Now, if you're working with children, again, you need additional training. Yeah, as you know, because I know you wrote a foreword for Shawnee Thornton Hardy's beautiful book that addresses that issue. Yeah.
All right, Libby. Well, thank you for your candor today, your willingness to show up as you are and use your experience to help us understand. I mean, I think that is brave, and I'm just really grateful that you're willing to share yourself this way. And do you feel like you could take on clients that maybe might want to work on these types of issues who have autism?
Issues secondary to autism? Yeah, I can. But again, I'm moving to Montana this fall, so maybe not right now. But I can be found on my profile on the International Association of Yoga Therapists website. If anyone wants to get in touch with me, my email is available on there. And maybe in the future, I'm still finishing up a second yoga therapy diploma right now. So I'm not really doing anything but that right now, but soon. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Amy. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Libby Walness, for enlightening us today and really helping us to understand what is the most important part of working with someone who's neurodivergent and especially autistic. What I got out of this conversation was create a safe relationship, which means doing a lot of work on yourself to be able to hold that space, and also not making assumptions about who this person is, not projecting ourselves onto them. Ask, talk, get feedback, be in relationship together. Last thing I want to say is this word, alexithymia, is so interesting to me that you may not have words to go with the sensations you're feeling in your body. And that is something that I see a lot in people with neurodivergence. And we at Optimal State have a mobile app to help people do that. If you go to the iPhone store or the Android store, you can try it for free. And it's based on yogic philosophy, but it's just that is helping to feel what's going on inside of you, find a word that goes with that, and then track those sensations over time and maybe even find some interventions, yogic interventions to feel a whole lot better. So go ahead and grab the app and see if you have alexithymia and if you can actually target the sensations inside of you and what words go with those sensations. All right, everybody, have a great week. We'll see you soon. Thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour. We hope that you enjoyed this content. Much of what we talk about goes right into the other work that I do. One of the really exciting things coming up soon is a program that I'm running with Mala Cunningham called Mental Health, Neuroscience, and Yoga, a peer counseling certification training. There'll be two parts. One of the parts will be online, and the second part will be in person. And at the end of this program, you will be a certified peer counselor who knows how to be in relationship with respect to mental health, neuroscience, and yoga. It's a two-weekend program, and we can't wait to invite you to learn more about it. If you're interested, go ahead and email welcome@theoptimalstate.com. Again, welcome@theoptimalstate.com, and Mala and I will get back to you to let you know the dates and locations of the program. All right, I hope you'll join us. Let's talk soon. A special thank you to our team here at Optimal State. We are truly a global family. George Mantuan, one of our executive producers. Adam Satchel, senior media producer and sound engineer from the Philippines. Krishna Panchal, a producer from Canada. Modupe Abdullahi, who does the show notes and is an editor for us from Nigeria. And Peter Morley, who wrote and produced the music for this show, who lives in Australia. Find more about Peter's work at www.zenmusic.biz. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.